Welcome to Voting 101, a We're the People podcast all about voting from a nonprofit that's also all about voting. Over the course of this podcast, we'll be covering everything from how voting started, the many fights for voter rights over the years, and how to actually cast your ballot. All to get you ready for November's midterms.
And beyond.
Well done.
Thanks. This week, we're talking about SCOTUS.
Gesundheit.
Wow. How do you feel about that as a joke?
50-50.
Yeah, same. Anyway, so as some of you might know, SCOTUS is the acronym for the Supreme Court of the United States, which is the highest court in all the land.
Like Alicia Keys says, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. But if you made it here, you probably didn't make it anywhere else, because in order for a case to get to the Supremes, you have to have lost in the lower courts. Also, if you make it here, there's no point in making it anywhere else, because there's no higher court.
So, not like Alicia Keys says.
Right. So, Supreme Court, SCOTUS, highest court, the Supremes, lots of nicknames.
You love a good nickname.
I do. Nicknames, and as I've learned over the course of this podcast, math. I love nicknames and math, and I have a vested interest in Mandy Moore's career.
All right, let's get focused here.
Sorry. So, longest intro ever. This week we're talking about recent Supreme Court decisions in voting. Before we jump into that, Sasha, want to give a quick rundown of how things work in the court?
Of course. The Supreme Court was established by the U.S. Constitution. Article 3 of the Constitution establishes the federal judiciary, and Section 1 of said Article 3 states, "The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish." That's my Constitution voice, if you were curious.
I was very curious what that was.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. I tried to do it in an earlier podcast, and it didn't really come through.
I noticed.
Anywho. All right. Even though the Constitution established the Supreme Court, it's up to Congress to decide how to organize it. Through the years, the Supreme Court has had anywhere between 5 to 10 judges. Right now, we have 9. 1 Chief Justice and 8 Associate Justices.
Just like all federal judges, Supreme Court justices are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate for what is typically a lifetime appointment, which is always a big deal because, as we know from recent news, presidents try to appoint judges that align with their politics. So if a judge were to step down, they would try to do so under a president that holds their same values. For example, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. RBG probably wouldn't be planking and thinking about leg day if we had a president that was more in line with her politics, because it's very possible she would retire. Maybe. I don't know. It's also possible she'll live forever. Good for her.
So, how does a case get to the Supreme Court? 2 ways. I love when I answer my own questions.
You do.
You can either get to the Supreme Court through appellate or original jurisdiction. Appellate jurisdiction happens when a case goes to the lower court and loses. At that point, those involved can petition the court to overturn or affirm the decision of the lower court. There's also original jurisdiction, which is a case that has not been heard by lower courts. So, this would be a case involving an ambassador, or a public minister, or when an entire state or states are one of the parties.
Each party files a brief that outlines their argument. If the court decides to hold a hearing, each side gets half an hour to present their cases, though it's possible to extend that time. Once the court makes their decision, the opinion is written. The case needs to be won by majority, not unanimity. So if the court is split and some judges disagree with the verdict, a dissent is written, which can be just as potent. When RBG isn't planking, she's been known to write some blistering dissents.
So now that we're all caught up on how the Supreme Court works, let's talk about some recent ruling on voting.
Yes, please!
We'll start with a super important case in 2013, but we'll need to provide some context. So, Kim, since you were alive then, why don't you talk to me about 1965?
I'm literally 4 years older than you. Anyways, you might remember from our episode about voting rights. 1965 ushered in a new wave of laws meant to protect voters and those attempting to register to vote. The Voting Rights Act was signed into law by President Johnson and then amended 5 times by Congress to expand its coverage. It was split into sections, including Section 2, which is sort of like a blanket. You can't prevent people from voting just because they are a racial or language minority. There were also protections against things like literacy tests. Section 5 is the pre-clearance requirement that requires specific states and counties to go before a federal court if they wanted to change any voting laws. It didn't have to be everyone, just specific places where there was a proven track record of voter disenfranchisement. To determine who needed this pre-clearance, Section 4B created a coverage formula.
And that brings us to 2013 and Shelby County versus Holder. This case started in 2006 in the district court when Alabama's Shelby County sued U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder under the belief that Sections 4B and 5 were unconstitutional. both the district court and the court of appeals hard passed, and the case was sent up to the Supreme Court. On June 25th, 2013, the Supreme Court ruled that Section 4B was unconstitutional because it exceeded Congress's power to enforce Amendments 14 and 15. What does all this mean? Well, it rendered Section 5 the requirement that states and counties with a history of voter disenfranchisement needed to go to the federal court for permission to make changes totally useless because they removed the formula. Senator John Lewis, who fought for voter rights and whose face is scarred from the beatings he received as he did so, and now serves as a United States Senator, said this turned Section 5 into a zombie, a body with no life in it.
Remember I mentioned that RBG could drop some scorching dissents? She pulled no punches here. Quote, Congress approached the 2006 reauthorization of the VRA with great care and seriousness. The same cannot be said of the court's opinion today. The court makes no genuine attempt to engage with the massive legislative record that Congress assembled. Instead, it relies on increases in voter registration and turnout as if that were the whole story. See Supra at 18 to 19. Without even identifying a standard of review, the court dismissively brushes off arguments based on data from the record and declines to enter the debate about what the record shows. One would expect more from an opinion striking at the heart of the nation's signal piece of civil rights legislation.
In the court opinion, Justice Roberts wrote, quote, a statute's current burdens must be justified by current needs, and any disparate geographic coverage must be sufficiently related to the problem that it targets. The coverage formula met that test in 1965, but no longer does so. Adding, coverage today is based on decades-old data and eradicated practices. The formula captures states by reference to literacy tests and low voter registration and turnout in the 1960s and early 70s, but such tests have been banned nationwide for over 40 years, and voter registration and turnout numbers in the covered states have risen dramatically in the years since. Racial disparity in those numbers was compelling evidence justifying the preclearance remedy and the coverage formula. There is no such a disparity.
To which Justice Ginsburg said, throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet.
She also said, hubris is a fit word for today's demolition of the VRA. And she was right. 2 hours after the ruling came down, Texas's attorney general, who is now the governor, Greg Abbott, passed a voter ID law.
Gross.
Yep.
It's also worth noting that the VRA ruling came down the day before the court ruled that DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, was unconstitutional. Marriage equality is a huge deal and obviously, absolutely worth celebrating. However, and this could just be me, but it does seem like the court understood that the backlash against the total abolishment of voting rights would have been huge if there wasn't something to take away the focus. Let's face it, marriage equality passing is a heck of a lot more exciting than something called Section 4B's coverage formula.
That is a fact. We're going to link a few articles about Shelby versus Holder on our website, but there are so many more. For good reason. Because this is a landmark case with far-reaching consequences that produce legal battles still being fought today.
Dun, dun, dun!
What's happening?
Oh, we don't have sound effects or anything, but I felt like this would be a good place for it.
All right, that's fair. So let's talk about some of those cases that stem from that ruling. We've got Husted versus A. Philip Randolph Institute. Here, the court basically gave the green light to Ohio's voter purges. Ohio uses a failure to vote as the first step in taking people off voter rolls. Garrett Epps from The Atlantic notes that the decision was made on a very narrow analysis of the National Voter Registration Act of 1993 and the Help America Vote Act of 2002, while also noting that the Shelby County versus Holder decision created a legal method of voter purging.
In Texas, there's Texas NAACP v. Steen. This is that voter ID law that Abbott signed hours after the Shelby County v. Holder ruling came down. In 2011, SB 14 was created as the strictest voter ID law in the country, forcing voters to present an unexpired voter ID from a list of only 7 acceptable forms. It's been estimated that more than 600,000 registered Texans did not have an ID that was approved under the law, and that number doesn't include the many, many more that were unregistered but eligible voters. The voting protections in the Voting Rights Act prevented its passing because they couldn't prove that it wouldn't discriminate against African American and Latina voters. In October, the District Court of the Southern District of Texas ruled that SB 14 violates Section 2 of the VRA by impermissibly abridging African Americans and Latinos' access to the ballot, was passed by the Texas legislature with the intent to discriminate against minority voters, imposes an unconstitutional burden on the right to vote, and constitutes an unconstitutional poll tax. This case is still being appealed and tried. In June of this year, Texas filed a motion to dismiss claims that the voter ID law violated the Constitution and the VRA. In August, a response was filed that argued the Fifth Circuit had ended the case and there was no further action on the merits for the district court to take. Texas's motion is still pending in the district court.
In North Carolina, just a few months after the Shelby County versus Holder ruling, the state instituted HB 589, which instituted a strict photo ID requirement, prevented early voting, cut same-day registration, restricted pre-registration, ended annual voter registration drives, and eliminated county boards of elections' ability to keep polls open for an additional hour. Crazy enough, the bill was originally written as a voter ID law. After the Shelby County ruling, the state legislative leaders expanded the scope of the bill. Immediately, the Department of Justice, the North Carolina State Conference of the NAACP, the League of Women Voters, as well as other groups and individuals sued the state. The Brennan Center for Justice submitted an amicus brief in support of the plaintiffs in the case NAACP versus McCrory. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit struck down the law in July 2016, finding that it targeted, quote, African Americans almost surgical precision, which, duh. The court ruled that HB 589 violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and the Constitution. On May 15, 2017, the Supreme Court denied North Carolina's appeal, which, on the one hand, is great, because who knows how they would have ruled given what they decided in Shelby County v. Holder. But on the other hand, you brought this on with your ruling. Why not hear the consequences?
Totally. And not to be a downer here, but unless this ruling is overturned and that formula is restored, there will continue to be cases like this. Just this year in Georgia, where Stacey Abrams is running and could become the first black governor in the state's history, the Secretary of State, who happens to be running against Abrams, although I'm sure that's just a coincidence, highly recommended closing 7 out of 9 of the polling places in a majority black county, which is completely ridiculous and doesn't even try to pretend to have a reason for it.
It's absurd. But here's what I want people to also understand. These polling places didn't close. Why? Because there was a national outrage about it. People made noise and refused to let this go quietly. And that's the takeaway here. People refused to give up and instead decided to be a voice for their county and their state. It's a really frustrating situation that also has a pretty great ending. The people were heard.
Thanks, Sasha. I feel better now.
Great. Well, then on that note, let's talk about gerrymandering.
Thanks, Sasha. I feel worse now. Wait, is it gerrymandering or gerrymandering?
What are you talking about? You know how to pronounce it.
I just like jokes.
Mm-hmm. I know you do. The term gerrymandering was first used in the Boston Gazette in 1812 in reaction to a redrawing of Massachusetts state Senate election districts under Governor Gerry. Is it Gerry?
No, it's Gerry. See why it's a genuine question.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
It is Governor Gerry?
Yeah.
Like, that's how you know. You should spell Gerry J. It's a name.
Listen, I know.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. Okay, great. Well, anyway, getting on with Governor Gerry to benefit his Democratic Republican Party. And was said to take the shape of a mythological salamander. The district, that is, not the governor. We're going to put up a picture online because it really does look like that.
At night, it comes alive and eats your votes. In reality, gerrymandering really does create an unfair advantage in districts, giving power to a specific political party by creating a majority. You should really look at some of these pictures, these so-called districts, because it's insane.
It is. There are 4 ways that gerrymandering can happen. The first is called cracking. Cracking spreads voters of a particular type among many districts, so their voting power in one large block is diminished. Political parties in charge of redrawing district lines might create more cracked districts to retain and possibly even expand that power. For example, they might split in an urban area among several districts where the majority of voters are suburban, under the belief that the two groups would vote differently. and the suburban voters would likely get their way in the election.
Another way to do it is called packing, which is the opposite of cracking. Packing means districts would be drawn to concentrate as many voters of one type into a single electoral district to reduce their influence in other districts. This is usually done when the party controlling the redistricting process has a statewide minority, because by giving up just a few districts packed with the opposition, they can then crack the remaining districts.
Then there's hijacking, which happens when two districts are redrawn in a way that forces two incumbents to run against each other in one district, ensuring that one will be eliminated.
And finally, there's kidnapping. Kidnapping just straight up moves an incumbent's home address to another district. This is usually done as a move against politicians who represent multiple urban areas. Larger cities will be removed from the district in order to make it more rural.
Those names are all so serious, which is fair because gerrymandering is a serious problem. It throws elections to people that haven't truly earned it. And just as serious, it creates a proven cycle of voter apathy as well.
There are multiple partisan gerrymandering cases going on right now, including this bad boy that went all the way up to our friends at the Supreme Court.
That bad boy is called Gill versus Whitford. Here, 12 Wisconsin residents who historically have voted Democratic filed a lawsuit in January 2015 with the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Wisconsin, challenging the legislative district plan drawn by the Republican-controlled legislature following the 2010 census. They argue that the map unconstitutionally discriminates against Democratic candidates and voters on the basis of their political beliefs. In April 2016, the three-judge federal panel ruled unanimously to allow the case to go to trial. This is the first time in 30 years that partisan gerrymandering claims survived a motion to dismiss. The trial was in late May and put two questions to the court. One, whether the Wisconsin State House had been drawn with a discriminatory partisan intent, and two, if there was intent, did they have a constitutionally discriminatory effect? In November, the court issued a 2-1 opinion holding that Wisconsin's legislative plan was an unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering and ordered the Wisconsin legislature to put a plan to fix it in place by November 1, 2017. Wisconsin filed an appeal on February 24, 2017, asking the Supreme Court to review the decision striking down the map. And in June of this year, the court remanded it back down to the lower court because the plaintiffs had not shown enough evidence.
These cases are so frustrating. But beyond that frustration, we also have to keep that fire in our bellies. We have to remember that everyone deserves fair access to the polls. If you're in a state that has these new laws put in place, demand to know why. Make sure as many people know as possible. I don't care if you have 3 or 3 million followers on Twitter or Instagram, tell them. Tell your friends and your family and your one friend who isn't on social media so you have to update them about stuff that your friends are posting, but you're not mad at it. You kind of like it. Tell everyone. And then tell them this too. These laws are meant to prevent people from voting. So the best way to fight them, vote.
These cases are really important to know about, but what we hope this episode didn't do is make you feel like there's no reason to vote. There is a reason to vote. There are a million reasons to vote. And in fact, everyone trying to manipulate the system is, in fact, a reason to vote. Because you are in charge of who we're electing and who makes those decisions. They work for you. So if you're unhappy with what they're doing, make sure they know that.
So there we go. That's Supreme Court rulings and voting. Come back on the next episode when we talk about why you should vote. Spoiler alert, the list is endless. Don't forget to tell your friends about us and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, or wherever you're listening to us. You can find Sasha on Instagram and Twitter at Sasha Slayman, and I'm at Kim Moffitt. We're the People on Twitter, and We're the People ORG on Facebook and Instagram, but don't worry. Make it nice and easy for you by putting everything on WeirdThePeople.org. We'll also have links to everything we talked about here.